Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Fireside Chicago. I am your host, Tim Shum. I'm also the founder and president of a recruitment firm here in town called Lucas James Talent Partners. With us today, we have Horacio Busa, founder and CEO of Fooda. You might not have been in Chicago for very long if you have not heard of Fooda before. You've probably seen their food service at various office buildings, events at your company. Horacio and the team have scaled that from Chicago to multiple cities across the United States. He's got an awesome backstory, Chicagoland staple in a lot of senses. So we're excited to talk to Horacio today. Horacio, thank you so much for carving out the time for us, and was looking forward to chatting with you today.
Thanks, Tim.
Absolutely. So I mentioned it for folks that are like in downtown Chicago, working office buildings in the suburbs and otherwise, they probably run into Fooda before. But you know, you've been in and around Chicago, the Chicago tech scene. Why don't you kind of give a little backstory on yourself, and then we'll get into what you're doing at Fooda here in a little bit.
Great. So, you know, background myself before Fooda, you know, I've been in C-level roles at B2B marketplace businesses for over 20 years. Prior to Fooda, I was part of three exits, two IPOs, and one sale to a strategic buyer. And right before Fooda, I was a president and COO at Echo Global Logistics, a tech-enabled freight management company here in Chicago. I was at Echo from concept stage until about a year after the IPO. We IPO'd in 2009. Before that, I was a COO and CFO at Innerworkings. It's a marketplace business for printed and marketing materials. There, I started about a year after the business launched. And I was there until right before we were getting ready to kick off the IPO process. And then before there, I was at a company called Bus Bank, which is a marketplace for charter buses that was is based here in Chicago. And that sold to an insurance company within the industry and still exists today as a wholly owned subsidiary of that insurance company. And so, that's my background, before Fooda. And I think what's interesting about my background is not only was I at, startups and startups that I was lucky to get, you know, a bunch of exits and participate in seeing them grow, but there's a relationship between, you know, the last three. And so, when I was at Innerworkings and we were getting ready to start the IPO process, we'd gotten some advice from bankers that, you know, might be a good idea to be more diversified. And so we started an in-house transportation arm. But several months into that process, we decided to spin it off and that became Echo. And then I went with Echo, right at concept stage. And so then I took Echo, through that process with the rest of our team. And at the tail end, about a year after our IPO, we had an in-house food program, which became Fooda. And so there's kind of a lineage there, between three separate companies that, you know, that are related from, a concept standpoint. So not everyone knows that history.
Yeah, I want to get to Fooda in a second because that's, it's a really interesting story on how it started for sure. But, you know, your background, it wasn't like you started Fooda in college. You know, you mentioned very humbly that you were part of two IPOs and exits and were at those companies, you know, really from inception. Talk about Innerworkings a little bit, because I know that, like, you know, for those that have been in Chicago and around the Chicago business scene a little bit, of course, we know of like the Groupon story, and then those that, understand the Groupon story, there's other businesses that were kind of started really by like the same crew, and you were a part of that, right? You were a part of that kind of initial crew, and that led it to Echo a little bit. Maybe start with Innerworkings. What did Innerworkings do, and, you know, what led to Echo, and then maybe just a little bit more detail on the first 5 years, because I think it's incredible that you go from inception to IPO in 5 years. It's almost unheard of.
Yeah. So Innerworkings was started, when all the markets crumbled due to the first kind of dot-com, meltdown. And so Innerworkings was one of the few companies that started, at the tail end of that, was really below the radar for a year or two. And what Innerworkings did is it set up a network of factories essentially all around the world. And so if you needed something printed, don't think letterhead and business cards, but think books, magazines, point of sale for large retailers, you know, manuals, if you're a manufacturer that, you know, is building, you know, heavy machinery. And so think, you know, that kind of B2B large, you know, type of print and marketing materials. Traditionally that went, that business would go through the large manufacturers like R. Donnelly and Quebecor at the time. And so what Interworkings did is say, hey, we don't need to own the factories. We could use technology to build a marketplace of factories all around the world, and we'll funnel that business to the factories that have excess capacity that are most suitable to handle this type of manufacturing. And so we built a network of about 5,000 factories all over the world and started selling primarily to the Fortune 500. Just to put in perspective, when I joined the company, I think our revenue was around, you know, $5 million a year on a, you know, run rate basis. I was like the 17th employee or something like that. And within a couple years, we were, you know, over $100 million in revenue, a couple hundred employees. At that point, we raised our first round of outside capital that was from NEA. So it was venture backed at that point. But before that, it was bootstrapped and the company was expected to be profitable. So in the first 2-3 years in business, the business was not burning a lot of money and you know, was very profitable. And so I think that's what, you know, some of the takeaways are that, you know, in tough times, like coming out of the first dot-com meltdown, you know, not everyone was burning lots of money and we didn't, that's for sure. We you know, used our profits to grow the business. And then, you know, at the tail end there, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we were starting to think about, you know, an IPO and sort of working with bankers. And that's when the concept for Echo, you know, came along. In terms of Echo, you know, focuses on transportation, specifically, you know, trucks, truckload, LTL. You know, most of our customers were manufacturers and distributors that needed to get goods from point A to point B. Most of Echo's business while I was there was domestic in nature, you know, did some international, but not very much. And so kind of did the inner workings playbook of, you know, building a supply network. And so in that world, supply network isn't the factories, but it's the trucks and the trucking companies. And so ensuring you've got coverage all over the US to be able to sell transportation, that, you know, that business works a lot like a SaaS business in that once you have a capacity, you could sell to anyone in the country, you know, and you get lots of economies of scale in that business.
It's incredible. So you went from bootstrap, 17th employee, grew that, IPO, spun out Echo, IPO. There's a lot of probably stuff in those 5 years that we could kind of talk about. And then you get the idea for Fooda. So maybe talk a little bit about that and how that materialized.
Yeah, while I was at Echo, we had an in-house food program where we would invite local restaurants into our space to sell food to our team. And, you know, it started as a one-day-a-week program and it grew to be our most utilized employee perk. You know, over the next 2 or 3 years from when that program first launched, Echo was growing as well. And so the program was very successful. Echo's offices are in the 600 West Chicago building, AKA the Groupon building. And so a bunch of other startups were based in that location and a lot of non-Echo employees started going to Echo space to utilize the program. I think it's really important at this point to mention that I had nothing to do with the program. You know, I was, you know, one of the executives at the company. I would eat the food periodically, but, you know, it wasn't my idea. I had, you know, very little to do with the great success that the perk had. But, you know, I saw it and I observed. And so by late 2010, about a year after Echo had IPO'd, I was already in the process of transitioning out of Echo and thinking about what I wanted to do next, but I was still there. And so I saw this opportunity. I heard our head of HR come in and complain that a lot of the people that were buying the food didn't work at Echo. And so our high-tech solution at the time was to hang a sign that said, if you don't work for Echo, you can't use the program. and honestly, didn't think anything of it at the time. And then about a week or two later, I thought, you know, this could be another marketplace business where, you know, the supply side could be a bunch of awesome local restaurants the customers are the B2B, you know, businesses that want options for their employees. And one thing led to another, and I ended up making the decision to start Fooda. So that's kind of how we got started. But frankly, if it wasn't for Echo, you know, Fooda wouldn't exist today. And then once Fooda launched, Echo became our first customer. So they said, hey, you want to run this? Go ahead and run it. And so we've definitely taken that program to the next level.
Very cool. Very cool. So we'll get into a little bit more about Fooda in a second. You know, this is your baby. You know, you've grown it exponentially since you started it way back when. You know, we have a lot of different guests on the show, a lot of different entrepreneurs, some venture capital folks that started businesses before. Some started like in college, you know, some didn't go to college, right? Yeah. So they had no corporate experience whatsoever. You know, your corporate resume definitely speaks for itself. Your experiences within Inner Workings, the Echo team, your counterparts during that time, how did that have an impact on you when you were starting your business? Ultimately, how to get it up and running, maybe fundraising, all the different variables that go into entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I think you bring up a couple good points that that I think it's important to share my opinion on something. So, you know, there's a ton of stories about people who didn't go to college, leave college early, start a business, you know, in their garage that, you know, ends up becoming a multinational business. And we glamorize those stories and a lot of those entrepreneurs. My story is nothing like that. You know, I think my story is more like, you know, by the book. And so, you know, I went to a Big Ten university. I went to, you know, University of Illinois, you know, got a supply chain and an accounting degree, and I'm a CPA. So I had that like business foundation. I went to work for, at the time, Amoco, which is now BP, you know, which was the largest company in Chicago at the time. So I valued, you know, my corporate experience. And then, you know, after that, I also worked at a couple other, you know, pretty large companies. And I, when I'm talking to people that are earlier in their career, recent grads, I don't discount working at a big company. You know, big companies that are successful got there for a reason. You know, they could, there's a lot to learn there about how to, you know, do things right, you know, and look, that's not how to do a startup. It's different. But as you end up having success at a startup, having the experience of a larger enterprise and what it means to do things a certain way and scale and governance and those kinds of things have come in handy for me, you know, especially as companies that I've been a part of have grown. And so, yeah, so like, I think that early part of my career was really important, and it didn't have anything to do with startups. You know, startups really weren't a thing, you know. Now, that being said, I was always the kid and the recent grad that was always doing a side hustle. You know? So, you know, I had a paper route as a kid. You know, most kids don't even know what a paper route is anymore, you know, where I sold newspapers and delivered newspapers. I used to sell baseball cards on the side. And then after I graduated, I saved money, you know, with a friend, and we bought a building in Chicago and became landlords and learned how to do that. And so I was always doing things that were entrepreneurial in nature. But you know, I also had that large company expertise. And so when I then went to a startup, you know, my first real startup, I think, you know, was Bus Bank, you know, which was venture back, you know, I had the end in mind with that big company experience, but I also didn't need anyone to hold my hand to make decisions because I already run, you know, small little, you know, let's, you know, call them those side hustles, you know?
I think, it's so interesting to hear people's perspective on this, because I think a lot of people that'll be tuning into your show and your podcast will be interested in how you got to be successful. And it is, in my opinion, a normal path. I'd spent 10 years at a multi-billion dollar company myself. And I think, yeah, one side, like work for somebody else, learn from them, get a promotion, go through some adversity, and like prove to yourself and give yourself confidence that you can kind of work through that. Be a questioner, think, put yourself in other people's shoes and ask yourself, why am I making these decisions, or why are they making these decisions? I think that's such valuable experience, and then just like thought energy, that when you ultimately get in the seat of making your own decisions and the outcomes are either your success or your failure, That's a big deal. That's a big deal. I believe my corporate experience fast forwarded my growth at my company, because I've already kind of made a lot of mistakes when somebody else has done, so to speak, is one way of looking at it. On the flip side, I'm kind of kicking myself that I didn't start my business earlier, time value of money, and, you know, make these mistakes along the way. Maybe Lucas James could be a lot bigger along the way, but everyone's got their own story.
Yeah. I think the key is, you have to make do with the opportunities that are in front of you. And, you know, I don't come from, you know, a family that had like lots of means. I mean, we were like lower middle class, working class, you know, type of family, but, you know, I did get the opportunity to go to, you know, college. I didn't have to worry about student loans at the time. You know, college cost a lot different. You know, the way college worked, you know, 25, 30 years ago was different than it is today. And so, you know, when I came out, I didn't have anyone's money to start a business or anything like that. So I had to go to work for someone, you know. On the other hand, I also didn't have student loans to worry about. And so I think each person's situation, you know, puts them in a unique position that, you know, listen, if you're 25 years old and you have the capability, skill set wise and financially to start something, gosh, you know, that's great, you know. But most people don't, you know, and so you need to start working at a normal job, and, you know, you have to figure out a way to save money. And everything I read and see, it's really hard, a lot harder to do that now than it was when I was 25. You know, not starting your own business right away is just not in the cards for most people. You know, I think we have to acknowledge that. You know, for some people, you know, if you do have that desire and you get an opportunity to do it later on, that's fine too. But hopefully you've gotten some experience along the way that helps you become more successful, you know, or reduces the odds of going out of business.
Right. Yeah. And if you wanted to start a business today, maybe it is, think 3 years down the road, save some money along the way, read, listen to podcasts like this, like educate yourself on how things work. What are different funding opportunities that you have? I think that there's so much to learn about that to increase your chances for success, to your point. You've been around the Chicago scene for a long time. The title of this podcast is Fireside Chicago. This is all about learning from prominent leaders, from yourself, but really ultimately making Chicago great. You've been around the scene a long time. I mean, Inner Workings, Groupon, that group that you were a part of, you've seen the Chicago entrepreneurial / tech scene kind of grow along the way. Maybe speak to that scene when you started to what it's become today. And, you know, you obviously have experience too with capital partners from the coasts and investment bankers from the coast with the IPOs and things like that. Maybe just speak to the evolution of the Chicago scene in general.
Yeah, sure. I definitely have, I've seen some things. And so I think first of all, from a talent standpoint, Chicago has an awesome talent pool. The problem is, as of the last like 5 to 7 years, it's no longer a secret. I mean, I think we need to acknowledge that, you know, especially when you look at the large tech companies, they all have a, you know, pretty large presence in town. You know, they've been hiring engineers and data scientists now for several years. And so, I don't think it's any easier to hire in Chicago, maybe a little easier than the coast, but Chicago has lots of great talent, but specifically on the technology side, it's not much of an advantage anymore if you're a startup in terms of finding and being able to afford some really good people. I think in other areas like sales and marketing and operations, it's still a nice little secret. You know, you can find awesome people with great experience, pretty affordable, and they're available if you run a good company, you know. Not so much on the engineering side, I think, at this point. I think on the fundraising or money side, Chicago still lags the coast, you know, when it comes to VC presence as well as activity. The bar is much higher than the coast in order to get funded. I saw this at FUTA. I mean, I had prior exits, tons of experience, really good traction. And I'll tell you, fundraising for FUTA was still probably one of the hardest things I ever had to do. And so, you know, it's not to say that you can't raise money if you're in the Chicago or the Midwest, but you need to be a lot better than the companies at the coast. And the reason I've come to that conclusion is that I've seen the, you know, the stage that companies are at when they're raising money. And when I, you know, compared them, you know, the ones that were based on the coast with ones I was familiar with here in the city, in Chicago, I would say that, that they were the ones on the coast were able to raise more money earlier, and probably didn't have to try as hard. And I think that still exists today. You know, that being said, there's a lot more options in Chicago over the last 15 years. There's been lots of progress made in comparison to Chicago before then. So we've come a long way, but let's not kid ourselves. You know, we still have a long way to go.
Yeah, there's this documentary. I've mentioned it on the show before. It's called Something Ventured. It's on HBO. I think it just sits on there. It's about just the evolution of Silicon Valley. It talks about the semiconductor industry back in the 60s, millionaires that were generated from that, then reinvested that capital and reinvested it. And then you had the dot-com boom, and then that capital was reinvested. And there's a huge ecosystem there as it relates to that. There's a bunch of Lucas James talent partners that are supporting that scene. There's coaches, there's platform. There's a lot of energy there. And to your point, like we've grown a lot over the past 15 years. But what do you think needs to happen to maybe accelerate that growth of the ecosystem?
Yeah. You know, I think my opinion and, you know, pre-COVID would have been that even more companies need to hold out and not sell as early. I mean, I think everyone's written those articles already and how Chicago companies tend to, you know, have a higher portion that end up selling to strategics along the way, as opposed to taking it all the way to IPOing and being independent. Because that's where the, you know, the big kind of exits really happen, you know, that are broad-based or more broad-based. And so that would have probably been the thing, and it's very hard to change because, you know, along those same lines, if you're, you know, I could tell you from an entrepreneur standpoint, if you have to work that much harder to raise money, it takes you several years longer to get to a certain point than maybe a comparable East or West Coast company. And so by the time you get to the point where, you know, you're capable of IPOing, you're kind of tired, you know, and maybe like a good offer comes your way and you're like, hey, you know, maybe we should take it, you know, because I'm already, you know, X years in. Where, you know, if that would have happened earlier, you might say, you know what, let's give another 2 or 3 years and let's see what happens, right? And so, so that'd be the thing. I think now, you know, I don't even know, you know, given everything that's going on, you know, in Chicago and other large cities regarding whether it's COVID or whether it's racial justice, and how the, you know, cities like Chicago or other large urban centers are going to be impacted in the long run. I don't even know yet. I mean, it's very hard to think that far along, but I think it probably starts with Chicago and Illinois getting its finances in order so that we don't have that backdrop. You know, if you talk to someone, you know, outside of Illinois or Chicago, you know, they're very familiar with our budget issues, or very familiar with the violence that happens. And so I think getting that as a start under control is part of what's needed in order to build that foundation. And unfortunately, we're gonna have to rebuild that foundation. And it's, Chicago's not alone. I mean, we've even seen this in San Francisco and in New York. There's, if anything, they probably have an even bigger issue right now with people leaving than we do.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, it's tough to stomach, and it's tough to watch. There's just been so much growth in the past 5 years. And you mentioned like some of the, hey, it's no secret anymore. From a talent perspective, yeah, LinkedIn came to town and employed thousands of people. Glassdoor was in town, thousands of people. Salesforce, all these, and Uber, you know, and then a lot of those plans due to COVID changed. You know, a lot of layoff activity has happened, specifically in the technology community. And when I think about it, it's like, I think people underappreciate, like, this is a labor market here, and each job that was lost is someone's salary. $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 jobs times thousands and thousands. And then that money goes into restaurants. That money goes into like everything else kind of within the community and gets passed around. And, you know, there was a lot of growth there, but I think, you know, we're resilient. I think the points that you make around some of the things that we got to figure out, but yeah, it's, you know, we were on a good growth trajectory. And I think once these things get figured out, we can continue that as a community.
Great.
Absolutely. So let's move to Fuda. You know, we haven't talked too much about that. So you started the business. Take us through the growth story and where Fuda stands today.
Yeah, just to, you know, level set, you know, we've been around almost 10 years. We operate in about 20 metro areas across the country. You know, pre-COVID, we had about 2,000 customers, about 2,000 restaurants in our network. We're venture-backed. We raised $45 million in equity up until this point. Our business is one where we work with employers and property managers to provide on-site food options to employees at their work locations. Employees generally pay for their own food, but sometimes employers will subsidize and or pay for all the food. Fuda doesn't cook the food. We don't transport the food. We don't serve the food. Our restaurant partners do that. So our focus is on designing software that enables the marketing, logistics, and transactions to take place. For example, we have our own point of sale system that restaurants use when they're executing Fuda events. The key to our business is that consumers get a different restaurant each day, and restaurants go to a different site each day. And so there's this movement going on. And so consumers love the variety, and restaurants love the marketing exposure that they get by going to different locations. Our traditional target market was, you know, large employers and multi-tenant buildings. So we often compete against the legacy food service companies like Compass, Sodexo, and Aramark. You guys are familiar with those. And so, you know, what's changed a little bit over the last, you know, 6 to 9 months, the change started happening probably 3 years ago, which is that, you know, we started primarily with people that are in office locations and individual companies. And so as we've grown, we've not only grown on a geographic basis by adding cities, but we also started adding other services and segments. And so about 3-4 years ago, we started adding hospitals. We added other types of healthcare locations, higher education. We do some work within junior and regional colleges. We do a bunch of work with the military as well as government locations, whether it's city or state governments. And so all those segments are still considered, you know, essential workers. And those, for the most part, are you know, similar to what existed, you know, pre-COVID. Unfortunately for us, our core business was primarily people that were going in the offices. And so we've had to obviously, you know, refocus our efforts. We've gone through and had furloughs and dealt with sites being shut down. And several of those have already started opening up. And so, you know, we believe we're in, you know, kind of a long-term, you know, resetting of the market, I guess is one way to think about it. And so, unfortunately, I don't believe that the office is gonna change in a big way from where we are today. In other words, being for the most part closed, until we have some kind of solution in place for COVID, you know, whether it's a vaccine, whether it's therapeutics, whether, you know, in some locations it ends up being herd immunity. But bottom line is, until we're on the other side of this and schools are back in session and we've addressed the active COVID cases, we've checked off mass transportation, all those things need to be checked off before employers feel comfortable promoting their office again. I think based on my conversations with CEOs at companies of all sizes, whether they're clients or non-clients, for the most part, I think CEOs and management believe that the office is an important part of their future, but they're kind of in a holding pattern. And so there's really no reason right now to push employees back into the office, given all these unknowns and given that a lot of places, you know, most offices and workplaces are fairly dense. They're indoors. People can't go to work because their kids are at home. They're not in school. They're doing remote learning. And so until we're on the other side of, you know, a recovery, I think we're going to see pretty low occupancy in offices, and we're probably in for another 12 to 18 months of that. I don't think this changes in Q1 or Q2. I think we have a long way to go. And so that's our mindset. And then when I think about the post-recovery and what, when, if we were to compare, you know, we're on the other side of this to what it looked like beforehand, I think at best, we cap out at 50 to 75% of people are back in the office. I think there's going to be a permanent blend of office and remote work. And so I don't think, you know, anyone at this point believes that we're going back to the old way. That being said, I do think companies will promote the office, will figure out how to work through some of the logistical and healthcare issues around having dense, you know, places. But if we're on the other side of this, those will all get figured out, and you know, 50 to 75% of people will be back in the office.
Well, while we're on the COVID topic, and we'll get back to growing food up, but you know, I'm getting the sense from you, you're very much a realist. You know, like, we don't know what's going to happen, but I think as a leader, to just have like unbridled enthusiasm for like a situation that's outside of your control might be the wrong leadership style in this kind of environment. And we're a recruiting firm, you know, I guess we're not a movie theater or a hotel, but we're definitely like center right of that. And we've gotten affected by that too. And I think as a leader, you have to be really realistic and make decisions kind of based on whatever that realism is. How would you speak to, you know, your leadership style or your thoughts around this through the adversity that we've been through, just kind of as a society, and then, you know, leading your company through the situation?
Yeah, I mean, you and I met the summer, you know, post-COVID, so you didn't know me ahead of time, but it's pretty much how I've always been. You know, like, I'm kind of a straight shooter, realist, some of the words you used, pretty consistent, right? And it's like, I have enough things to worry about than trying to put up a facade. So that's not me. It wasn't me when our business looked different. It wasn't me when we were early, you know, it's just not me. And that's just how I operate, and that's how our team operates. And so it hasn't been hard from that standpoint. It's been sad, you know what I mean? We've gone through some, you know, really difficult things over the last 6 to 9 months that I never thought I'd have to deal with in my life. I think, you know, earlier we were talking about, you know, the path that my career has taken, and I have more of what I would consider the traditional, you know, work at a large employer, et cetera, you know. And when you think about my experience in regards to dealing with adversity, you know, I'll tell you, I've dealt with very little adversity. You know, I haven't been a part of a bunch of companies that had to pivot. And, you know, I've been a part of one company at one point that, you know, was funded during, you know, the late stages of .com that, you know, didn't survive. But that's been the only company out of all the companies I've been at. And I was there relatively short, you know. And so I don't have that pedigree of like rebuilding a business after, you know, an economic downturn. It's like, I've always been about growth, consistent growth, getting better every day. And so this is new. This is new. And our team knows that, you know, and we talk about that. So when you say, you know, or you ask, you know, what are the things that managers can do during tough times like this? I think it's the same thing you do during the good times. And one of them is transparency, you know, and we believe in transparency. And one of the ways that I think about it, transparency at every level, whether you're talking at an all company meeting or one-on-one as a manager to someone who works for you, and you're having a tough conversation where it's not good news, you know, before you have that conversation, just pretend like you are that person and ask yourself, what would I want to hear? You know, and I think most of us would say the first thing is, I'd want to hear the truth. You know, that's where it starts. And if for some reason there's confidentiality or the truth isn't fully baked yet, the answer isn't to make something up. You know, the answer is to start to kind of share the direction of where the truth is going to be, you know, not ignore the truth, right? And so that's one of the things I think that helps people be consistent is start with the truth, start with being transparent, have empathy, and think about what you would want if you were on the other side. I think the, you know, I think it starts with that, you know, and if it starts there, then you, you're consistent and there aren't as many surprises along the way.
Love it. I love it. Yeah. I think a lot of people listening to this, if I had to categorize or profile our audience and our listeners, it's either earlier stage entrepreneurs, earlier stage managers, or ambitious individuals that always have some sort of carrot that they're kind of chasing after. Now, you know, I'm sure there were a lot of people that were your peer at Inner Workings. Other people could have got like a tap on the shoulder to go run Echo, right? And you have to consistently hit performance targets to keep the jobs that you were at in your corporate environment. For someone that's listening to this, that's ambitious, that wants to get that experience, that wants to move up the ranks, what's maybe some advice that you would give that individual?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, something that I would tell our team along the way, and this works at really at any level, but, you know, especially at startups, is that a lot of times people join startups and they think that they're going to join something and be working on a lot of different things, like in different functional areas and kind of move around and all that. And there is some truth to that, that there are some opportunities that present themselves at a startup where you have the ability to move from, you know, one department to another and have different roles. But while you're in a role, you need to focus on that role. You know, don't worry about the other stuff. And the analogy I like to use is, let's pretend like we all lived in a community, you know, and it's, and in this community, you have your house, I have my house. And I noticed that, you know, your yard's not clean. You have a bunch of stuff all over your yard, you know. I shouldn't worry about your yard, you know. I should worry about my own yard and my own backyard. And I always tell people, you know, keep your own backyard clean, you know? And if we all keep our yards clean, then the entire community will benefit from that. And the entire community will thrive. You as an owner and as a neighbor, you shouldn't be worrying about my backyard. You know, if I'm doing something that's inappropriate, there'll be someone that takes care of that issue, you know, whether it's the city we live in or the homeowners association, you know, leave that to someone else. You know, because I will tell you, at a company, senior management isn't stupid. You know, we are aware of who's keeping their yard clean and who's not. And you're going to be judged based on your yard, not whether you told your neighbor that their backyard was dirty. You know, and so focus on your job, be the best you can be at running your area, or being an individual contributor in your area of expertise, and become an A player. You cannot get that those other responsibilities, whether they're managerial or otherwise, by being a B or C player. It just doesn't happen. And so you need to be an A player within your level, within your role, and you do that by focusing on your own stuff and being the best you can be.
I love it. I always tell my team, you know, business is a lot like a high school group project or a college group project. And you always had the project manager, like the go-getter that kind of, you know, went above and beyond, kind of kept things organized. You have the person that kind of went through the motions, but just made sure that their house was in order, at least their backyard was safe. And then you had the person that, you know, really didn't give their all. And then the fourth person probably didn't even show up. it was the burnout of the group. It's same thing in an office setting, you know, like, if you want those opportunities, you got to be that person. You have to keep your head on a swivel. You have to treat your career with respect. And then if you're not, then, you know, you're probably not going to get those opportunities and you can't complain about it. I think that's a great point.
Yep.
So, Razu, thank you so much for the time. You're a busy guy. You got a lot going on, personal and professionally. I really appreciate you carving out the time. A lot of people know about Fuda, but if people have not heard about Fuda and want to check you guys out, where can they learn more about your company?
You can learn about us at Fuda.com.
That sounds good. That sounds good. Thanks. Thanks for the attendees. Orazio, we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Great. Thanks, Ken. Have a good one.